what Francois referred to as an experiment which builds on, to some extent, builds on the results that will be coming from these microwave background experiments to probe the physics of dark energy in new ways. And so the outline of my talk is to talk about one of the projects that we know well because we've done a full end-to-end simulation of it, the LSST. But there are a number of proposed probes of dark energy that are actually very synergistic. And I'm going to talk about the different types of probes, different types of measurements one can make, of distance as a function of redshift, different kinds of distances as a function of redshift, and of different measures of gravitational clumping and growth. And then an important issue, which Francois talked about in the context of Planck, controlling systematic errors, what one does there. And then finally, ways in which we can use all of this data to test more general models of dark energy that are beyond the simple 2D model. So here's a, if you want to survey the optical sky, you want to get a lot of light per unit time into your detector because you want a good signal-to-noise ratio. You want to be able to tile the entire sky many, many times. And therefore, you have to have a wide field of view in addition to collecting a lot of light. So you basically have to build a facility which collects a lot of light per unit time, has a big aperture, but at the same time has a huge field of view. And then you just continue to tile the sky repeatedly. And here's a number of projects, some of them in existence already, some of them that we've used for years. And here is the measure of survey capability. It's basically the product of what I was just describing, the light collection capability times the field of view. You get a big product of that up around 320 meters squared, degrees squared. You can actually tile the entire sky every few nights. And then you just keep on doing this for a decade. It's done with 15-second exposures in this particular experiment. About 2,000 of them for every tiny piece of the sky. And that's the LSST. Give you a measure of the size. This is a 8.5 meter primary mirror. And it goes wide, fast, and deep all at the same time because of its large étendue. It is unique among all of the dark energy probes in this sense. This is not a breakdown of gravitational physics. It is an artist's conception of the optics in the LSST. The light comes down from high Z, goes off of three mirrors and into the camera optics. It is only with three mirrors that one can, in fact, get the kind of crisp, high-resolution imaging over a very large 10-square-degree field of view. This is the first optic. Actually, it's two of them in one. The first mirror and the third mirror are cast together and then figured from that one casting. This is taken last Christmas when we were putting the glass into the mold for this so-called M1, M3 mirror. It is now finished its casting, and we take the lid off in mid-July. We know the contents are in great shape because we have five cameras in there, and it was a fun movie to watch when it melted. It's in a spinning, it was in a spinning oven raised to 1200 degrees C, and at that point, we stayed there for about 6 hours. At that point, the glass slowly flowed down in through these reentrant holes here, forming a very rigid, large structure. The other large part of the long lead item, and I might add that both of these things are very long lead items, is the camera. And this is a picture of the camera. It's about the size of a small car, about the weight of a small car. It has a huge entrance optic and then two more. And in it is a focal plane consisting of a new kind of imager, new kind of CCD imager, and 200 of them. This is our multi-filter band. So in that camera, although it wasn't clearly shown, are some very large optical filters, passband filters, just sort of analogous to the Planck different six wavelength bands. This is a six-band optical filter from the ultraviolet to the near-infrared. And this is total throughput, including the atmosphere and optics and detector. And we've actually built some of these devices and tested them, and they work pretty well. And so we have end-to-end simulation. This is a picture of the focal plane. This is a very large focal plane. And you can see it's over half a meter in size. And you can see that it's pretty filled with science detectors. Around the edges of the focal plane are wavefront sensors, which sense perturbations in the wavefront caused by atmospheric disturbances, misalignments of the telescope optics, et cetera. And all of this information is sampled about 100 times a second, and corrections are made in real time to the telescope optics to correct for all of that. This adds to the ability to get very, very crisp images. Our new charge-coupled devices are turning out really well. We have three vendors that are competing against one another, possibly four now. And we'll do a down select soon. But this is a wafer from one of the vendors. It's a new kind of device that combines some of the aspects of CMOS detectors with a charge-coupled device, very low noise behavior. And it's thick, so it's thick, high-resistivity silicon, fully depleted with a high voltage across it, which allows us to get that good quantum efficiency out almost to the band gap of silicon past 1 micron. There are a number of institutions that have joined the project. There are 24, as of yesterday, 24 institutions that have joined the project and that are have scientists and engineers working on the project. In addition to these US institutions, IN2P3 in France has recently joined, and a number of other foreign institutions are considering it. These are folks that are working on the project. In addition, there are 10 science collaborations, which are semi-autonomous, set up around 10 science themes, going from solar system astronomy to cosmology. And that number is about 200 currently, and it's growing very fast. The funding for this project is a public-private partnership. These two long lead items, the camera and the M1, M3 mirror, have been funded privately and has allowed us to start on time, on our schedule, so that we can maintain our timeline. The agencies involved are the NSF. The NSF is the lead agency, and the Department of Energy, Office of Science, High Energy Physics. And the data, contrary to literally all of the other experiments or probes for dark energy, is open. That is to say, it's not proprietary data. Oops. So this is where it's going to be located. We had an international site selection committee a few years ago select this site near CTIO, but not at CTIO, in northern Chile. In fact, you can see the Gemini South Telescope sitting over there. This is where we are located, or will be located. We started some site preparation work. This is a list of the features of the survey itself. It's a six-band survey covering at least 20,000 square degrees to a very, very faint depth, 27.6 magnitude. And each piece of the sky, each little piece of the sky will be imaged 2,000 times. So extreme control over systematic errors. This is our requirement for our flux accuracy. I might add that, as you probably saw in that picture, it is not an equatorial mount. It is an alt-azimuth mount. And as a result, as you take data on pieces of the sky over time, each image is rotating, will be rotating, rotated on the focal plane. This gives us new control over systematic errors that we don't currently have in our current facilities. Just to give you an idea of how deep this thing goes, this is, if you go to, you want to go to your favorite piece of the sky, go to, say, Google Sky and click on some coordinate. This is what is delivered up to you. This is a color picture of a tiny piece of the sky, about 7.5 arc minutes on the side. And you can see a couple of galaxies here. This is from photographic plates that have been digitized. A couple of galaxies and maybe a handful of stars. This is what you see from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, which is much deeper, higher quality data, and more bands. Those two galaxies, nicely shown now, finally, and perhaps 10 stars and a few other galaxies. This is the same piece of the sky that we have taken with the 4-meter telescope recently, a survey that ended late last year called the Deep Lens Survey. This goes to about a half or a third of the depth of LSST, and it has some artifacts, of course, that will be missing from our detectors. But you can see that the two galaxies here are seen quite well, and there are 1,500 other galaxies in this tiny 7.5 arc minute field. LSST will be going about 3 times deeper and much, much higher angular resolution. So instead of the usual mantra these days in surveys is millions of galaxies, we'll be doing billions of galaxies. Sort of like the Carl Sagan, the young Carl Sagan joke. Hundreds of stars. So we've done full end-to-end simulations of the experiment. That is to say, the first order of business was to construct an operation simulator. The way we did this is to take real weather data from that site, real information with regard to the shape of the stellar point spread function on that mountain over a number of years, and pick randomly from that distribution, creating a simulation of the operations of LSST under the science requirements driver. So you want to do certain science. Here is the question is, you're here on the sky, where do I move next and take my next exposure? Operation simulator has allowed us to simulate 10 years of operation and populate for each wavelength band the depth of coverage that we get doing that. That's helped us quite a lot in our ability to forecast our accuracies for all the science. In addition, we have now put together an end-to-end simulator for the actual images, starting from cosmology, going through the atmosphere, into the telescope optics, into the detector, and through the pipelines. And that gives us images which we can then do experiments on and develop algorithms. Finally, we've been using another 8-meter class telescope in a good site in Hawaii called the Subaru for sanity checks. So we've been playing LSST on Subaru and comparing it with the Hubble Space Telescope images of the same piece of the sky. So this is a Hubble Space Telescope advanced camera for surveys image of a 2 arc minute piece of the sky, 34 minute exposure. And here's the same piece of the sky on the Subaru, a 20 minute exposure, showing all of these galaxies are detected quite well with a better signal to noise ratio. And we will be taking far deeper images with the LSST. So we will be doing shape measurements and redshift measurements, color redshift measurements, using these 6-band information on 3 billion galaxies. And in the time domain, because of the fact that we can constantly go back to the same piece of the sky many times, 1 million supernovae, 1 million galaxy lenses, and lots of asteroids, and in particular, more exciting things that we can't guess. For dark energy, there are a number of different types of probes that this experiment does. It does a lot of different kinds of gravitational lensing correlations, which I'll talk about in a minute. It does baryon acoustic oscillations over a large sample, counts of dark matter clusters, supernovae out to a redshift of 8.8, very complementary to the space missions that have been proposed. And in particular, it probes for the first time, uniquely, the possibility that dark energy could be anisotropic. Anyway, I'm going to concentrate on this synergy between baryon acoustic oscillations and weak gravitational lensing, because they remove degeneracies if you combine the analysis from the same data using the same galaxies. And there will be an astro pH on that out tomorrow, I believe. This is an example of what you can do with weak gravitational lensing. That is to say, you use the shapes of hundreds of thousands, in this case, of background galaxies in a small field of the sky. This is 2 by 2 degrees, to invert and figure out what the foreground mass distribution looks like. And this is a picture of the mass distribution in a 2 by 2 degree piece of the sky from that survey I was referring to earlier. These are all real masses. We pointed the Chandra X-ray telescope at them, and sure enough, we see soft X-rays coming from each one of these clusters, so from the baryons. But this is a picture of the non-baryonic, primarily, cold dark matter distribution in that direction. But of course, you can do this as a function of redshift, too. So if you have these background galaxies, their shapes are systematically distorted by foreground overdensities of dark matter. And the shapes tend to be correlated for sources that are close in angle, but not necessarily three space position in the distant universe. And the correlations tend to die off at large angle. These shear cross correlations and their auto and cross correlations and their spectra encode in them information on the dark matter distribution and the development of cosmic structure, because you can do this as a function of redshift for the sources in different redshift bins using the color redshift information that you obtain from having six colors on each one of the 3 billion galaxies. So this is a predicted power spectrum of the shear power spectrum. That is to say, this is the Fourier transform of that shear correlation function. And what is not shown is the cross-correlation function. So these are just auto-correlation, auto-spectra, power spectra at different redshift bins for those background galaxies from nearby to far away at the top. And there's a range of L that is useful for probing the physics of dark energy through weak gravitational lensing, all the way from the limit down here at L of a few tens, where you tend to be cosmic variance limited, all the way up to the point where baryons, on the order of an arc minute or a few arc minutes, baryons start tugging in very dense regions, start tugging on the dark matter, and it becomes a gastrophysics problem. However, there are cross spectra, and if you had 10 redshift bins, this is just 5, but if you had 10 bins, which is really easy, you could get 55 auto and cross spectra, plus higher order terms. So the baryon acoustic oscillations are shown here. You all know about these wiggles in the microwave background. They, the galaxy distribution of galaxies since then has imprinted in it the same information from the acoustic oscillations. And that's shown here in a prediction by Hu Zhan. Of the power spectrum relative to no BAOs of LSST in its survey. So we should be able to do pretty well on color redshift baryon acoustic oscillations. So this is basically a 2D effect on the two-point correlation function. So what can we reach in terms of capabilities of dark energy on the sky? Integrating over the entire sky, one can get this phenomenal increase in accuracy by combining weak lensing with BAO. So weak lensing in the WA-W0 plane is shown in blue. BAO is in red. Of course, we also have supernovae, which I won't discuss. You combine BAO with weak lensing, and you collapse to this inner air ellipsoid. And you take all the data together, and you have this orange ellipsoid. So it really does break degeneracies very nicely. Systematic errors are important, and we have to learn to control them. And one of the ways we are learning to control them is to play games on the Subaru telescope. I mentioned that very briefly. Here's just an example where we've taken a bunch of short exposures on the Subaru telescope, asking ourselves the question, how lousy can it get when you have pretty average seeing on Mauna Kea? How lousy can it get in terms of the induced residual point spread function, correlation function? So this is bleed through after correction for the stars in the shear-shear correlation functions. And just with five exposures already on Subaru, you're way down below the cosmic shear signal, and we will have 2,000 with LSST. Going out to even larger angles, this is the result of a full simulation with just one exposure. You can see even at larger angles, you're pretty good. And of course, goes like one over the number, not one over the square root of the number of exposures, because this is the two-point correlation function. Finally, Jeff Newman has found a really clever, ingenious way of calibrating the photometric redshifts. It's one thing to have decent photometric redshifts with some sigma, with some noise. It's another, of course, to have systematic errors, which we know we will have as a function of redshift, of the photometric redshifts versus the true redshifts. He's found a clever way of calibrating them by using the cross-correlation in angle between a low redshift spectroscopic sample, training sample, and for the same field, our high redshift photometric sample, which has in it a few galaxies that are overbright that are in the low redshift spectroscopic sample. And therefore, you should see a two-point correlation function when the redshifts are correct between the two. What do we get as a result of all this as a function of time? So this is down here is what a particle physicist would call integrated luminosity. And we call it Eytandu time. From year one out to 10 years, in terms of the Dark Energy Task Force air ellipsoid area, shown here in the left for the separate probes treated just by themselves, not combining the data in any way, and not using Planck. Excuse me, this does include Planck priors, excuse me. Supernovae are this red area, and it's rather large and wide simply because we don't know how accurate the standard candles, how standard the standard candles are. In blue is the weak lensing, and in green is the BAO. If you now combine just the BAO, you combine these two together, and move over to the right-hand side, you get what is shown in red, and you notice the scale has changed. You go down to about 10 to the minus 3 in these units if you combine all of this with Planck priors. First light in 2014. The survey and operations will be between 2015 and 2025. So how well do we think we can do on a somewhat broader problem? Mainly, suppose you just step back and ask, how well can you measure distances or growth of structure as a function of redshift in these photometric redshift bins? In our simulations, we've been using 20 bins, which we think we can easily reach with the photometric redshift accuracy of 0.002 times 1 plus z. And here on the vertical axis is the fractional error in either distance measures, which are shown in blue, or growth of structure measures, which are shown in red. The solid lines are without the Planck prior, and simply marginalizing over all the cosmological parameters. However, the symbols are with Planck priors. And all of this, by the way, includes rather conservative estimates of what our systematics are going to be And you can see that we can measure distances to the sub-percent level over a fairly broad range of redshifts. This means that we can, in principle, test more complicated models of dark energy than the two-parameter simple model that most of us have been playing with. Whoops. So here's a few slides from Andy Albrecht showing how that might work. So certainly there's no a priori model that tells you that you should have some crazy dark energy that behaves delta W as a function of Z behaves like this. But suppose it did, how well can you do in various experiments? And so this kind of model allows you to explore a wider variety of W of A behavior. And if you found a signal for any of this stuff, in other words, a time-varying behavior, it would reject the vanilla lambda model. A number of folks have been using this approach. So I'm going to show you quickly, and just take a look at the very top panel in all of these, how the march of time might help us in terms of getting better and better handles. So this is a prediction that was made by the Dark Energy Task Force for so-called stage two dark energy experiments, mainly what's being done now. And you're going to hear later this afternoon from Mike Hudson about, for example, the Canada-France-Hawaii survey. And these are the various eigenmodes. And so you can see that you can do more than two, even with CFH. You could probably do three, maybe even four, if there's a big signal. If you look instead at the same plot for the dark energy survey, you see you're doing better. You could perhaps go up to four, certainly three different parameters. If you go to LSST, you might be able to go up to seven. This is the signal-to-noise ratio from our end-to-end simulation. So what about even crazier ideas? Suppose, I mean, we know actually nothing. I don't have to tell this audience, we know nothing about the physics of dark energy. We have guesses. As an experimentalist, I think it's our obligation to check some other crazy ideas. Mainly, suppose that it's slightly anisotropic. Here is our coverage. Here's our coverage of the sky. We can do 360 in one direction. What if? We can measure the dark energy here. We can measure the dark energy there. We can measure the dark energy there. We have a huge enough sample. We have 3 billion galaxies and 1 million supernovae. So in summary, here's a bunch of different ways that one can probe dark energy using a rich survey that looks at 3 billion galaxies and 1 million supernovae over half the sky. And I don't have time to go through all of them, but they're all cases that have been made in the literature. But this machine now does it using the same well-studied and hopefully well-understood systematic error, anyway, data set. I just should close by pointing out that one of the byproducts of all of this activity will be a measurement of the total neutrino mass. And that's simply because we get the power spectrum of dark matter, all dark matter, both relativistic and non-relativistic, to high accuracy as a function of position and time. And what's shown here is the neutrino mass, total neutrino mass, and then the lightest neutrino mass horizontally. And LSST should get us down into this region down here around 30 millielectron volts for the total neutrino mass error. So this is where you can go for more information. Thanks.
Questions? Philip.
Oh. Yes, I was curious to know why you can't see no supernovae above redshift of 0.8.
Why? So at redshifts much larger than that, most of the spectrum, first of all, the spectrum of a supernovae is quite rich compared to a galaxy. So it's in some sense easier to get a redshift to the supernovae and to classify it than it is for an average galaxy, which has rather smoother features. So you'd think you'd be able to do a really great job, even a better job with the supernovae than you can with galaxies. The problem is that those features tend to move out of the optical passband of LSST at around a redshift of 1. It becomes very, very hard. Supernovae, if there's any problem that has currently been identified and nailed with supernovae, it's the UV and the absorption of dust in the UV and the funniness in the UV. And that UV, those UV systematics in the standard candle get redshifted into the optical passband above about 0.8.
As you said, we don't understand the physics of dark energy. There's a large number of published papers claiming to explain dark energy. And they all fit, or most of them fit, or some of them fit the supernova data and the WMAP data. What particular observations will LSST give us that can distinguish between all these models?
So that's a good question. Since we can combine, let me back up a little bit. Certainly something like this, where you measure a time dependence of dark energy, kills any lambda model. And this is the only experiment that has the capability of measuring this behavior with time. However, more generally, we can measure a lot of distances. And there's a very direct prescription from the vanilla lambda models for how distances and growth behavior behave as a function of cosmic time. More generally, if I move all the way back to there, of course, this is drawn around the magic point 0 minus 1. Which is the vanilla theory. The object is to get a small air ellipsoid so that if the real theory is over there, you can drive a truck through that gulf between those two. So even in the sort of standard two-dimensional theory, a two-dimensional model of dark energy equation of state, the goal for all of our experiments is to reach a very, very tight air ellipsoid. But I think the smoking gun would be to find using a broader model, more than two parameters, to find evidence for time variation.
All right, I think we'll have to move on from here. Let's thank Anthony again.